Hey, good afternoon. So, first some logistics stuff. So there's a assignment on exploiting format strings, which is out as you probably saw. I, because of a Git mistake, neglected to post the executable until Sunday. So I've extended it a day to Saturday in case anyone was being responsible and starting when the assignment was released. On the note of finishing assignments on time, I note that a substantial number of people, but probably few enough people that they could all not be here, didn't finish the overflow assignment on time, which I guess means I needed to put an intermediate deadline or something to encourage people to start before the last week, as I suggested was necessary. So I'm aware of that. I'm not sure what I can do at this point beyond saying, no, that happened. Hopefully you'll take me seriously when I give you 2 weeks to do an assignment in the future, and I can try to avoid that. Okay, so last time we talked about a whole bunch of mitigations, including reviewing stack canaries, which we saw before, which were a way of making it so stack overflows that overwrote the return address were detected before we actually used that return address. And we also talked about this more general mechanism that the hardware supports of letting us make memory, when you access it, trigger seg faults. And that's really handy if we can make the buffer overflow that the attacker tries to do trigger a seg fault, which sometimes we can do. And that had these limitations that we needed to work in these 4 kilobyte units. We couldn't protect anything smaller. So we couldn't do anything really fine grained, like mark all the function pointers as read only, but not the things around them. But this was sometimes handy. So for example, if we were worried about overflows which were just going over the end of a buffer, if we have a big buffer, we can put a guard page around it, a region of memory that will trigger a set fault. And we started talking about ASLR, that's address space layout randomization. And this is the idea that a lot of the exploits we have involve putting an address in the input to the program and getting that address stuffed in a useful location, which means you need to come up with an address in the program. So the idea of ASLR is we just make all the addresses random. So you can't put an address there, assuming the program never ever prints out an address to let you figure out the address you want to know. And so we're gonna continue talking about ASLR and some practical issues with it, which explain why didn't this happen like in 1995? And people were originally worried about these sorts of problems. Why did we spend so much time not having this feature at all? And basically what happens with ASLR on Linux with 64-bit is that we have these random offsets for various regions of memory. The stack is still contiguous. It's not the case that ASLR randomizes how much we decorate the stack by. It just changes where it starts. The heap still out managed in the usual way. Malloc will allocate objects the same way it did without ASLR. It just starts in a different place. And libraries we load are still loaded in the same sort of way. They just have a sort of random location that they start at. They still are loaded in one big chunk because that's how they're designed to be loaded. There's a big chunk of code to copy from the file to memory. We just choose a random location for that. And on 64-bit, we have this problem that we only have 4 gig of addresses, and we probably want the program to be able to use most of them. So we have much less flexibility, which means that we only vary location of the stack by a little bit, and the location of libraries by a little bit, which means that we are left with less choice as far as where we're starting things. So with 64-bit, the attacker would need to guess 30 bits to figure out where the stack is. So if you're doing our overflow assignment, you needed to write an address on the stack in your exploit string. If you had ASLR and you tried to do this with 64-bit machine that used ASLR, you would need to try 2 to the 30 times on average about before you got it right. So if we had some program like servers often do, which restarted every time it crashed, you could try 2 to the 30 times and you get it right. That's not very practical, and that's why ASLR is effective. If you had a 32-bit systems, you need to try 2 to the 8 times, 256 times, if you had something that was restarting. And in real cases where like someone has a server that's designed to automatically restart when it crashes, because who wants your website to go down, that's actually bad. But that's because we only have 4 gig to work with, and we don't want to like reserve 3 gig of that for a random padding. And another thing about ASLR is because we're just offsetting where these various regions of memory start, you know, we're actually really vulnerable to information leaks. So with stack canaries, you need to get this specific thing on the stack. So there is one you need to like magically access this memory location which the program never used. With ASLR, we're a little more vulnerable. If you have any stack pointer, you can figure out where everything is on the stack. So this means that if you have an information leak, for example, where you're reading from a buffer that wasn't initialized, and there happened to be a pointer where that buffer was, you have all the information you need, as long as you can figure out where that pointer came from somehow, which you could do by getting a copy of the program, running it in the debugger, and looking at what the value of that pointer is versus how memory is laid out in your debugger. So this means that, you know, pretty much any information leak that lets us read a pointer or uninitialized memory, which contained a pointer, like a buffer on the stack we didn't set to zeros, is probably going to let us, as an attacker, figure out what all the addresses are in some region of the code. If we have a pointer to the stack, it will let us figure out all the stack addresses, so we can figure out where the stack pointer, where the return addresses on the stack are, at least one of them. If we have a pointer or buffers on the stack, if we have a pointer to a library, it will let us figure out all the addresses in that library, so we can figure out where global variables in the library are, which will give us something we can maybe overwrite, which is a function pointer, for example. So it's vulnerable to that. This is what people do in practice. So in practice, people still do these memory exploits on systems with ASLR. They just usually rely on one of these things leaking somehow, which very frequently happens with some types of exploit, some types of vulnerabilities, and not others. So for example, use after free vulnerabilities almost certainly are going to let you do this. Because if there's a useful use after free vulnerability, probably you have a pointer in something which was freed that you're using. You can read. And some, like just a normal stack overflow, like we saw in the overflow assignment, doesn't actually let you do this. So it actually protects against some cases, but not many real ones. But there was a more glaring problem with this picture, and that's down here, which is that we have these fixed addresses. And these have writable data. We can write to these addresses. And this is actually something we don't want to be happen. So if I know a global variable in here, I can encode its address, because it's fixed. So we should just make these not fixed. So can we just load the program at a different place? Could we do that? So why do we have to load, why are we loading the program at this address? Why can't we move that to a different place? Yeah. So you say this is the only place that's writable. So we could like put it in this hole, for example. There's plenty of memory. This is 64 bits. Like this is not to scale. Like this gap here is like terabytes. So why can't we just move this coding constant to some other random part of memory? Yeah.
Can it slow things down?
So you're saying it would slow things down. So why would it slow things down? So you're saying it would be different because the common stuff would be in different areas of memory. I can see how you think this is a concern. There is a performance problem, but it's not quite because of the memory location we put things at. That's not going to be actually an issue. I understand if caches worked in a certain way, it would be, but they typically let us have the same performance no matter where we put it in memory. Yeah.
Aren't the stack
code nonsense.
Yeah, so you're worried that the heap and the stack you want to grow, so maybe we're limiting our space. So that would be a problem, but it's not really on 64-bit because we have, as I said, many, many terabytes here, petabytes of empty space. So we cannot worry that the heap will be big enough. So there's some problem, which is not that. So the OS could load this code and constants data up here. But if it did that and tried to run the program that way, it probably wouldn't work. So why not? Yeah.
If you had absolute jumps.
Yeah, so the problem is our program might have addresses in its code. So if we just load its code somewhere else, it's going to assume it's down here. And we don't have the information to fix that. So the machine code that we're loading contains these hard-coded addresses. Remember, we did something special for the non-hard-coded addresses. Just we had these stubs in a lookup table. But the rest of it doesn't do that. It's just a chunk of machine code which has addresses embedded in it, some of which are not relative. And we expect to load this without changes, and that's not going to work. Yes?
If you're moving it all as a big chunk, couldn't you potentially add something to every constant address?
So the question is, couldn't we just add something to every constant address? Yeah, couldn't we just fix this all up at load time? And the answer is, absolutely. This is something we could do. And when we did dynamic linking, we deliberately avoided this. And the reason we avoided it was a performance and space one. So the performance problem is that fixing up all the addresses is going to take a lot more time than constructing our lookup table for dynamically linked functions. That's a whole lot of stuff to fix up. Like if we're loading a megabyte program, we have to edit a megabyte of stuff rather than say it's like 4K lookup table of library functions. That's a lot of extra work we have to do each time we load the program. Also, when we load multiple copies of a program, we'd actually like to have only one copy of it loaded in memory, and this will make that impossible to do in a straightforward way. And we also need data on where the hard-coded addresses are. We can't just go through the assembly code, the machine code, and say, this looks like an address, I'll fix it, because we might get it wrong sometimes. So we need to know where the hard-coded addresses are, which means we need metadata that the linker can use to do this. And we already have that metadata in .o files, but we typically don't put it in .exe files. But it would make executables bigger if we had this. But this is a completely valid option. And in fact, one very popular operating system does this, namely Windows. So this is a difference between how Windows and Linux load executables and libraries. So on Linux, executables and libraries are just chunks of machine code you load. On Windows, there is actually this information to adjust the hard-coded addresses. But as I said, there's a performance cost to doing this, and Windows doesn't like that performance cost either. So they make a choice that reduces this performance cost at the cost of some downsides for ASLR. So their choice is that for every boot on every system, a program and library is loaded at one location. So for every library and every executable, they choose one place in memory it gets loaded. And one time, they do this fix-up. So if I have a library that's used by several programs, one time, we're gonna edit this code to change all the fixed addresses, and we're gonna load that edited version in every single application. So we only do the fix-up once, so we avoid most of the performance cost. But this means that every application has that library loaded at the same place, which means we've kind of lost some of the benefit of ASLR. If you know where the library is loaded in one program, you know where it is in every program on the same running system. So this avoids most of the cost of having some sort of a more centralized system. But this makes it easier to be compatible with existing programs. So Windows has done ASLR by default using this mechanism, which relocates the code once, since about 2010. And Windows, sorry, and Linux, because it doesn't do this, has taken longer. And we'll get show why when we look at how these relocations work. So in Windows, their strategy is that they load the program at a fixed location and they just choose that each boot. Every program chooses a new location. And they spend the cost once per boot. They assume that if you're running programs multiple times, that you won't see this cost, so it's not a big deal. That's their hope. But they are actually spending time editing all the code. And the idea of relocation, as people mentioned, is that we have like these addresses that we need to fix up. So when Windows stores an executable, if you have something like this, it's going to be stored with a placeholder value and a relocation record, which says, hey, at this location, offset 3 in this machine code, I want you to put whatever dot data is, whatever that address is, in this format. And this means a 64-bit signed integer. And this is what the Windows loader does. And on Linux, this is only done to produce executables. So you might wonder, since I'm talking about this, that Windows doing this, does this mean that Windows doesn't have a global offset table? Because you don't need one, right? You could just edit all the things, edit all the references to other libraries. And you could avoid a global offset table this way, and all those stubs, which we thought were, which were very handy for exploits because they were function pointers at constant locations we could overwrite. And Windows still uses that, uses a global offset table. They have a different name for it, but it's the same thing. So any guesses as to why they would do that? So you're saying it's still faster. So why would it be faster? Because it's less, because we have this stub. We have this extra code we run that looks up an entry in the table instead of just directly calling a function.
Well, compared to adding all those extra calls that we need for the change
in the address. So one good theory, which is a good one, is that yes, Windows is spending the time to change all these addresses, but if they had to deal with all the things that are imported from other libraries, that would take a lot of extra time. And they're avoiding that. So another reason that Windows does this is that the process of relocating an executable on Windows only cares about that executable. So it doesn't look at references to other executables. And this simplifies all that logic in Windows and also makes it so you can have two versions of the same library at the same time, which you couldn't do if you fixed up the references based on the library rather than what program is using the library and which other libraries it has loaded. Okay. So because Windows manages to do relocation by making this compromise of doing it once per boot, it makes a pretty big compromise for security. So for random addresses, we depend on people not being able to easily use an address they discover. Hopefully, or not being able to discover addresses. But on Windows, if you get, if you're on the same system and you load a library, you know where it is in every single application. So if you're exploiting a program that's running with, as administrator on the same system on Windows, well, you have all the addresses of libraries. Because you can run your own program that uses that library. So it's actually not useful against local exploits. It's also even worse in the case where you have like servers which crash and get restarted because they'll have the same memory layout the next time, which won't happen with the sort of Linux style implementation, which will choose a new set of addresses for every single program that runs. On the other hand, Windows actually had ASLR deployed in 2010, which Linux didn't. So Linux doesn't rely on relocations, which means that if you want your executable to have ASLR for the entire executable, not just dynamically loaded libraries and the stack and the heap, but for those constant parts we had at the bottom, if you want to do that, you need to have what is called position-independent code. It means there needs to be no hard-coded addresses. And this is not always something the compiler really wants to generate. So on 64-bit, we usually have code, generate code which uses offsets, relative offsets, and not absolute addresses, but there are some notable exceptions where the compiler doesn't do that, and it's not clear exactly how you do that. So one example is implementing something like a switch. So here I have a switch, and the implementation that GCC uses when you compile this is it makes a lookup table for the entries for 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, with pointers to the place and the function to go, and it uses that lookup table to jump. This is a nice, fast implementation which avoids having like six comparisons. And when this gets compiled, or assembled, I should say, this lookup table has hard-coded addresses in it. And this is one of the things we would need to fix up if we were doing a relocation. We need to take this table of hard-coded addresses and change it to actually have to actually be some sort of relative addresses and somehow have that work with this jump. But because we didn't, we have a hard-coded address in the jump pointing to this table. So that's one address we have to fix up. And the table entries themselves are hard-coded addresses. And this is not like most of the code. So most of the time, we don't have this problem in 64-bit x86. So for example, this jump here, when you see it in assembly, in the object dump output, it has an address here. But the actual encoding of that is this 12. As you can guess, the 12 is not the full address represented in some other way. It's the offset from after the jump to that memory location. Yes?
Is there not a way to make that jump use relative addresses?
So the question is there a way to make this jump use relative addresses for the lookup table? Well, that's the next question. So how can you rewrite this to use no absolute addresses and be as fast as possible? So it's an exercise you should be able to do. You can definitely come up with one implementation, which is if equals 1 equals 3 and so on. But can you come up with a good way of doing that? Suggest writing your strategy down. And it would help probably to remember that in the overflow homework, we talked about this RIP relative load effective address instruction. So that's probably useful for doing this sort of thing. Yeah. So there are instructions to load relative to RIP.
You have to know how far away the other function is from where you are, right?
What do you mean the other function? In this case, the return one, return two,
yeah.
Or this lookup table?
Yes.
So you'd have to. So yeah, the assembler will figure out how far it is as long as they're together when you write it that way.
So basically, you're
So this is a jump instead of a call here in our original, our version which uses absolute addresses. So the question is how to make this lookup table not use absolute addresses encoded here. These become absolute addresses in the lookup table. And the address of the lookup table is also an absolute address. So for the lookup table, we could, maybe there's a RIP relative jump. So that would be a nice instruction to have. And I can tell you that, unfortunately, the designers of x86-64 at AMD did not have that foresight. As far as I know. At least not one where you can specify two registers, RIP and something else. But you can get pretty close. You can like load effective address using RIP to get the address of the table and then use that. So that's going to be one step. As we're going to have a lookup table and we're going to load the address of the table and use that. But then we still need to somehow have the entries in the table tell us where to go to without having hard-coded addresses in the table. So any proposals on how we could do this and not be ridiculously, not like have 5, 6 statements? Yeah. Okay, so your proposal is that we load this lookup table first, and we change this lookup table to store offsets from somewhere in here. And then we need to add that value of that memory location, which we need to retrieve using the same way we loaded the address of the lookup table, and do that. And this is, in fact, basically what GCC actually implements if you tell it to generate position-independent code. So it stores it relative to the beginning of the table. It stores those offsets from the beginning of the jump table to the return. And it loads the address of the jump table, loads the entry from the jump table, adds it to the address of the jump table, and then jumps to that location. And this is probably about as good as you can do. And you'll notice that this took 4 instructions to do what we were doing in 1. And this is because the people who designed x86-64 did not have the foresight to make a lookup table relative to the current instruction and use some computation relative to the address of the current instruction to jump. They could have had that instruction, but they didn't think of it. Yeah. So this is probably not 4 times slower, yes. So the question is, what kind of slowdown is this? And I wish I could tell you. But I have not found reliable data on how much slower it is in the context of real applications. As we'll get to later, the best numbers I found in a paper on this were labeled as preliminary because they were really looking at a different platform, said like maybe 2-3%. For some applications, but it definitely depends on the applications because not all applications have any switch statements. Okay. So there's something called position-independent executables. This is the Linux name for when you build an application, so there's no fixed addresses whatsoever. And basically what it does to the memory mapping is the executables loaded the same way a library would be. And it can't have any hard-coded addresses. And on GCC, this is how you build one. You pass PIE and minus F PIE. So minus PIE is the linking option. So when you're combining .o files, it says don't choose an absolute address. And minus F PIE is the compilation option. It says when you're making your assembly code, don't put any absolute address jump tables or things like that in it. And that's where we get this code, which ends up storing offsets instead of, only has offsets and does computations with offsets. So we have this added cost that we have 4 extra instructions, and it's slower. I don't know how much slower. So 64-bit, this is not too bad. This is probably worth doing because very occasionally we have 4 instructions, and I saw those 2-3% numbers, but I'm not even sure that that's real. It seems high, given how frequently this happens and that for reasons of how processors work, there's other reasons for any form of this computed jump to be slow. So, it doesn't seem like a case where it should make that much of a difference. But the reason why it took a while for Linux to have ASLR all the time, the bigger reason is that 32-bit is way worse. So on 32-bit, RIP, relative instructions, don't exist. So this instruction here, this LEA with RIP, doesn't exist on 32-bit. Can't do it. You need to do something else. In fact, probably the easiest way of doing it is to use call followed by pop to load the address of the instruction pointer and then add to that. Yeah?
Can you do call with no?
Call uses a relative address, so that's why this works, if that's your question.
So are you saying like call anything? Or
you have a function like above your code, which is pop REX, which is like not pop, but like copy this thing at the stack pointer to a register return. And you just put that above your code and you call it, and the call uses a relative address, so that works, and that gets you the instruction pointer that you from the place you called. That is actually what GCC will generate for 32-bit mode. We'll generate that little function and call it. So remember we had stubs. And stubs are one place this shows up. So on 32-bit, the stub without position-independent code looks like this. There's a jump, and inside the jump, we have encoded the fixed address of the table entry for where this library function is. In 64-bit mode, this is RIP relative, that is it's relative to the instruction. In 32-bit mode, that doesn't exist, so the jump actually uses a fixed address. So what happens in position-independent mode is that this jump uses a register, which means that to implement position-independent code on 32-bit Linux, they change the calling convention for these stubs to say that you have to load EBX with the address of the global offset table before you call it, which means you've lost a register you can use in your code. And you only had 8 to begin with. One of them's the stack pointer, one of them's this now, and the function you're calling is going to overwrite REX for the return address. So you're way down on registers. So this is actually a pretty big cost. Not only do you have to load this, you have to wait, you have to save whatever you're trying to use that register for. And this means when people have benchmarked position-independent executables, there is a pretty good case to be made that maybe you shouldn't be using that, even though it really helps security to not have any fixed addresses that attackers can use. So this is the SPECCPU 2006 benchmarks. This is a commonly used benchmark for people to brag about how good their operating systems, compilers, and processors are. And this is the overhead from several years ago with some version of GCC of adding FPIE to the benchmarks with various optimization levels. There's different benchmarks with different performance overheads, and these are the averages. So it's around 10% slower. Now, 10% doesn't seem like much to get something which makes it extremely hard without an information leak to exploit a program, but it's not a good sell. And pretty universally, Linux distributions refuse to turn this feature on, except maybe in some select applications which they felt were sensitive. They certainly didn't turn it on by default, because this slowdown did not seem acceptable, especially since for some applications it's way worse. And this is the cost of having those extra instructions to call a function just to get the program counter and to waste this register on storing the address of the global offset table. And as I said, it's the same place I got that. Said they did a preliminary study on 64-bit and thought it was 2-3%, but they didn't actually like look deeply into it. And this depends on the version of GCC. Maybe GCC's gotten better at generating this sort of code. So this sort of scarcity means that Linux has taken much longer to have address space randomization happen. In particular, so my laptop, I'm running Ubuntu 16.04, which was released in 2016 April. Hence the letter, numbers. And about 14% of the executables on my system use position in, are position independent. The other ones have fixed addresses, so most of them still have fixed addresses. Even though it's 64-bit, they didn't feel it was worth the risk of lower performance or the risk of maybe breaking some application to turn it on. The next version of Ubuntu enabled it by default. Debian, Fedora enabled it around 2015, 2016. Has been people have started to be willing to turn this on by default despite the performance risks. Yeah?
Why don't they just enable it if your system is 64-bit and disable it?
The question is, why don't they just enable it for 64-bit? I don't know. As I said, there's probably still some performance cost on 64-bit, and maybe that's what they were concerned about. There's sometimes compatibility issues because people write really bad programs and expect them to work, which might expect that to happen. Especially if they have embedded assembly, it's quite possible that programs with embedded assembly will not be able to work this way. Though that should be less than, you know, 70% of my programs. Most of the programs don't have embedded assembly. That's probably why, but just looking at what happens. Yeah?
Would there be any way to generate an error code that specifically says, oh, this isn't meant for position-independent code?
So the question is, can we reliably generate an error when we have something which isn't meant for position-independent code? So usually, this actually just will refuse to link. Like, so not turning it on by default is a bit puzzling because you could turn it on and the things that wouldn't work with it would just refuse to link because they'd have a relocation in the final executable, which ordinarily would be replaced with a fixed address. And when you try to link in this mode, the linker's going to say, oh no, you shouldn't have that anymore. And we'll actually complain about this. Yeah. Or, I mean, the code won't fix it, but if you run this code, it will fail to link, so you know it's not compatible.
Yeah, and then you could turn it off for that program.
Yes, and you could turn it off for that program, and no, I have no idea why Linux distributions didn't do this in, like, 2012. But they didn't. And in OS X, they enabled it around version 10.7, enables PAE by default, even for 32-bit. They don't care, they decide it was worth it. OS X, I mentioned explicitly, works very similarly to Linux in how it deals with ASLR. So it's per program, each program loads things at random places, not like Windows. So any questions on ASLR in general and the reason it changes programs that you write? So let's move on to our next topic. So ASLR is one of the best mitigations out there. It's fairly cheap, at least on systems like x86-64, where we have good ways of doing things relative to the program counter. And it makes it much harder to do exploits. If you don't have an information leak, you basically can't do any of the exploits we talked about. You need to get lucky with like having some variable you want to overwrite with not out of pointer value being adjacent to your buffer or something like that, like the score in the quiz example. So it's really good. And there's another sort of thing which is at the same level, and this is going to be based on our page protection. So when we talked about the page level protection before, we could say any 4 kilobyte region of memory was not readable or not writable and would trigger a seg fault. And there's an additional thing we can do to that, which is that we can mark regions of memory as executable or not. So this means that when you try to do your Stack Overflow, okay, you finally defeated the ASLR, you got the program to print out an address on the stack. So now you got your overflow working and you write the return address to point to your buffer and seg fault. Because the operating system looks in this table, says, okay, you're here, Let's try to execute that. Oh, nope, sorry, can't do that. So the processor says no, because the operating systems table says no. And all we needed to do was add this extra executable table to our structure for, called the page table, for how memory is laid out, in addition to our readable or writable thing. So this is implemented on pretty much all modern systems. And one name for it is write XOR execute. The idea is that you're going to make memory either writable or executable, but never both at the same time. And this means that there's no way for an attacker to inject machine code in your program and have it run. If they can write, have the machine code be written when the program is running, it's not going to ever be executed, because it will never be executable. So you can only use code that already exists in applications and libraries. So we'll get into how attackers deal with this a bit later, probably the main topic for next time. First, you might say, why did I just start with it, the table looking like this? Why did I add this later? Why did I show you the version without an executable column? And the reason I did that is because the hardware started that way. Historically, on x86, execute permission was implied by read. So anything readable was also executable. It wasn't until about 2000 that actual support was added for saying things as not executable or executable. It started with 64-bit, had it all the time, but it was added around 2000 for 32-bit. So it used to not be an option. So there's some other reasons why this wasn't just automatically enabled. So around 2000, when this became a hardware feature, wasn't the case that all the operating systems turned it on? That took a while. It took like 5-10 years, just kind of like ASLR took that long. And just like with ASLR, there were compatibility problems. There are programs which depend on writing code and executing it. They're not your typical programs, but they exist. The most obvious case is we talked about virtual machines. And one of the ways of implementing it was writing machine code based on the old machine code and executing that. If we just turn on our write XOR execute feature, we're going to break those virtual machines. So that was a reason why this wasn't deployed originally, deployed right away, because it broke some programs. And unlike ASLR, you aren't going to get a linker error. If you just turn this on, you're going to have some program not work. And an example of a program which would not work is a web browser, which typically uses the strategy to implement JavaScript. So you need to exempt some programs. There are also some other places where people deliberately used writing code at runtime. Sometimes even on the stack. So you couldn't disable executable stacks because there were programs that deliberately wrote a little function on the stack and called it. So this wasn't something you could just turn on immediately, because yes, real programs did that. But these days, we just make sure our programs, if they need to write code and execute it, they need to make a call to the operating system and say, hey, operating system, I'd like to execute code that's right about here. Can you flip it from writable to executable? So they have to make an explicit call to the operating system to change that. Yeah. So the question is, would the attacker just make that call? So yes, the attacker would like to just make that call, but they can't write code to make that call and execute it straightforwardly. But yes, that would be an obvious goal of the attacker, because there will be a call to do this, because something like a virtual machine implementation is actually going to need to do this. Okay. So any questions about sort of basic idea of this? So yeah, it's pretty straightforward. If it's writable, you just never mark it as executable. And you can implement this rule in your operating system where you generate this table. You just make sure whenever you set the writable bit to true, you set the executable bit to false, and vice versa. Or not vice versa. So WriteX or execute is really nice, because unlike ASLR, it is essentially free. Except for these weird cases where programs end up deliberately writing code and executing it, it has literally no performance cost, which is unlike every single other mechanism we've talked about. But there's a problem. So with ASLR and Stack Canaries, we had this issue that we were depending on information and not leaking to the program, to the attacker, which is not a good assumption if our program is sloppy and has buffer overflows. Probably they're also sloppy with things that they output. And with WriteX or execute, we're depending on there not being useful machine code in the application already. So you might think that this is only really a problem if, say, our application has the code to make the call to unprotect the memory, for example. That's a reasonable assumption to make. Or if it has the call to like run a shell with a specific command. And if we just don't have that code in the application, we're fine. Now, it turns out that this isn't quite true. And the reason is that usually there is actually useful machine code in the application. And we just need to overwrite some function pointer to point to it. Now, the reason why there's useful machine code in the application is not because any random program is going to contain execute a command of my choice. That's not why. It's because it's going to contain snippets of code that we can use together. So there's a technique we're going to talk about and we'll have a homework on called return-oriented programming, also known as ARC injection or return to libc. And the idea of this technique is that we're going to find in the application somewhere not one piece of machine code that does what we want, but we're going to find a chain of different snippets of machine code that do what we want together. And we're going to somehow connect them together. As you might guess from the name, the way we're going to connect them together is with returning. And it turns out that on almost any real program, people have discovered that this allows you to do everything you could do by just being able to write machine code in the program directly. This is a surprising discovery, and people didn't actually know this until after people were starting to implement WriteX or execute and discovering how effective it was, which was not nearly as much as people thought. So I'm going to go through a simple example with return-oriented programming. So I'm going to have a simple stack buffer overflow, just like the one you had in homework, with no stack canaries to keep things simple and ASLR disabled to keep things simple. In practice, we could have them enabled. We just need something to like print out stuff, junk on the stack with a pointer and the stack canary. And that's what we do. So I have my, wow, that was great. My vulnerable application here. So you can see, straightforward vulnerability, same program that we wrote before. Had before essentially stripped down to its bare essentials. And we can look at the assembly. And the first step you should have taken for the homework, I hope, was, you know, figuring out where things are in the stack. So from this assembly, we can say, okay, so we're calling getS. The first argument to getS is going to be an RDI. So an RDI is loaded from RSP plus C. So that's where the buffer is. And the return address is at the top of the stack when we enter this function. And we decrement the stack by hex 78. So the return address is at 78 plus the stack pointer, which is 6C plus the buffer. Okay, so this is our setup. So we're going to overwrite this return address to actually do our exploit of choice. And the way we're going to do this is we're going to look for code in the C library. So this program calls getS. getS is part of the C library, so it loads the C library. And since ASLR is disabled, since there's no address space randomization, I can just figure out where the program loads the C library. And so it's going to happen that the program loads the C library at this address. And we'll switch to a demo, which I can tell. So here's the So here's our vulnerable program. So the way I can tell on Linux where things are loaded is that there's a special file for every program called maps in the /proc directory. So for example, I'm going to run this command. Pat just prints out a file and proc self maps. So self means the process is what proc stands for. Self means the one that's reading the file, and maps is a list of what's mapped into memory. That's the term used for setting up that table. And this actually gives us a dump of everything that's loaded into the memory. So we see bincat, the executable itself, is loaded at address 400,000 hex and 600B00 hex. And we can see that the heap is at this address, and libc is loaded at these addresses. Various parts of libc are loaded in separate chunks, but essentially you can just think of libc being loaded at the first address. And I have ASLR on. So if I do this again, I get different addresses. So this address here these addresses here are different than these addresses here, because I have ASLR. Every time I run this, I'm going to have different addresses for the things which aren't cat. And cat is not built with PIE. It's not position independent, so it gets loaded at the same place every time. So given this, I have my vulnerable program here. So first, we're going to turn off ASLR, because as I said, we're assuming that that's off. And I should do that with bash. And now if I run maps, it gets loaded at the same place every time. Everything is at the same place every time, this time, in this case. So libc is always loaded at this address in cat. Okay, so I want to find out where things are loaded in my vulnerable executable. So I have my vulnerable executable here. Oh, I know what I did. Okay. Vulnerable executable here called overflow.exe. And I want to see where it's loaded. So I'm going to run it in the debugger. Run. That does not tell me what I want to know. So I'm going to run it on the command line and control Z to stop it. And then I'm going to use PS. So PS tells you what programs I have running right now. And I have overflow.exe as PID 1288. So I'm going to look at proc /1288 maps. And this shows me where overflow is loaded. So you see that the executable is loaded at fixed addresses. And I can see that libc is loaded at this address. So if I were exploiting this executable, I wouldn't have access to this. But instead, I just get an address from somewhere in libc, and I know how it works with this mapping. I know I could figure out where libc was loaded on this table. Okay, so that's our setup. So we've done this work to figure out, since ASLR is turned off, where is libc loaded? And now I'm going to look for things in libc that I can use. So my task, I'm going to print out the message, you have been exploited, by calling the libc function puts. So most of the code is there. Puts is already in libc. I can clearly just run it. But I need to get this string, you have been exploited, in its argument. And I know where puts is because I looked up where libc is loaded. And I ran object dump on libc to figure out where is puts, given that it's loaded there. So I ran object dump with an option to say, show me where things are, given that this file is loaded at a particular address. There's an option to object dump to do this. Okay. So if you were doing it the old way, a way we might do this exploit is something like this. that I use LEA to load a string into RDI, then I load the address of puts and jump to it. Make sense? Any questions about this code? So we're going to try to find pieces of this code in libc. So first thing I want to do here is load a value into RDI. So I'm going to look for some code which loads a value into RDI in libc. And I search through libc, look for something which loads a pointer into RDI, and look, I found one. Something which copies the stack pointer, which we'll know where it is, and we can have something at the stack pointer when we do our exploit, into RDI, and calls something at a specified address. So I found half of this code in libc, just by happenstance. So if only we could make sure RAX is set to the correct value, and our string that we want to load into RDI is where the stack pointer is, we're there. So I'm missing one step, which is loading a string into RAX. So I'm just going to need something which puts the address into RAX. But first to set up, so given this, let's say, hypothetically, we could set up RAX to contain the right value in advance. How would this look like with our overflow? So what we could do, if RAX was already set up when we were doing our buffer overflow, is we could overflow the return address for the vulnerable function to point to this snippet of assembly, this address here. And have our string, which will end up being pointed to by RDI above it. Because after the return, that's where the stack pointer is. So that's what that would do. Now, this isn't complete because we can do this overflow, but it's going to probably segfault because it tries to call RAX, and RAX isn't an address of code to run. It doesn't point to the puts function yet. So we need a way to load an address into puts and then run this. So I'm going to look again in my libc for some way of loading an address into RAX and then going to some other code. And after looking a bunch through libc, I found this. So here's a call of some address, which has a relative offset, which contains hex 58, hex C3. Hex 58 is the opcode for popq RAX, and hex C3 is return. And I can use this. It doesn't matter that it's not really the instruction. The processor's not going to care when I tell it to jump to this address. It's just going to say, yep, I see a pop instruction there. We're good to go. And this ret lets us choose where to go next. So we're going to set things up. So when this return runs, what return does, remember, is pop an address from the stack and go there. So we're going to set up this return so it's going to pop the address of the next thing to do, which is to load a pointer into RDI and call RAX. So we're going to make a chain of these little bits of machine code, which are called gadgets, and it's going to cause us to actually do the effect we wanted of loading our string into RDI and calling puts. So what our chain's going to look like when we do the overflow, so we're going to overflow our buffer. So we're going to change the return address for vulnerable to point to our pop RAX return snippet of machine code that's already in libc. So we're just going to put the address of that place in libc there. And above that, we're going to put the thing that pop's going to use. So the stack pointer here is pointing to the address of puts. So we're going to make sure that pop consumes that. So it's going to increment the stack pointer again. And then return's going to run. It's going to look at the thing above it, and it's going to go to that piece of code. So above the at value for RAX, we're going to place the place to go, which is the next gadget, the gadget which loads the string into RDI and calls puts. So So what's going to happen when we execute this is that the return invulnerable is going to jump, is going to read this address, jump here. The pop is going to read the address for putus that we placed on the stack. Then the return is going to read the address of the second gadget, going to jump here, jump to that move, going to load the value of RSP, which is a pointer to that string that we put on the stack, and then it's going to call putus. And I promise that this actually works. So I have an example, something which does this. So here's my file to implement the exploit. So I know my return address is 108 bytes from the start of the buffer. So I print out some padding. I don't need a NOP sled because we're not writing anything in the buffer. It's not executable. And then I have these values I want to do. I have the address of the pop rex ret. I have the address I want the pop to read. And then I have the address of the move RSP then call. So if I it worked instead of you have been exploited. But so if I run this executable to a file, so I can see that I have my padding for the buffer followed by the sequence of addresses in the buffer, followed by my string, followed by a new line because that's what get us waits for. So if I run overflow.exe using this input, I in fact get the message, it worked, from the buffer, printed out. And then it cycles because it tries to return from putus and on the stack is the value of this value here as a pointer, which isn't a valid pointer. But that's something that's overcomable when you're doing a real exploit. You can like go to a function which accepts. Okay, so any questions about how this worked? So do people think that this is a practical, easy technique? Yeah. Yeah, so it seems like really annoying. Like, how did I, you might say, like, how did I find this, right? Did I really like load the object dump for libc, carefully scan through and find this? And the answer is that no, I am not really good at looking at object dump output. So there are tools that people have written which just scan a binary for these gadgets, including one you'll use in the upcoming homework, which will make the homework much simpler than you think. If you had to find these by hand, that would be really annoying. And in fact, anyone who's ever done this that I know of, if they don't use a tool that someone else wrote, they write one, because it's that important. So how would you find these gadgets? How would you write a tool that did that? What would you do? Well, it's a good way of doing that. Yeah.
What you did was trying to find a way to get putus. Then you realize you need to get something into a certain register. So then you find a way to get something into that register and then call the table. Just keep going backwards.
Okay. So your idea is to look for the final thing you want to do, like a call, and then work backwards. Do that. So let's start with a simpler task. How do I find what the candidates of things I can use are? Yeah. Yeah, there's some. Yeah.
Like I was thinking basically like search through the machine code, like kind of like a control object, and you're just like looking for like those two machine instructions.
Yeah, so maybe I can just say probably there's a pop ret, and I can just look for that. And this is sort of the start of the strategy. So the most important thing is about these gadgets is how they end. That not displaying slides at all. is how they end. So if you notice the gadgets we used here, they were both useful as these gadgets because they ended by going somewhere else. So that's the important thing we need. We need snippets of code that end by going somewhere else that we can choose. So either we chose it because it uses a register that we could set, or because it pops something from the stack and uses that. So the general procedure that you use when writing these tools is that you find bits of machine code that end with a return or a computed jump. So the way tools that do this work is they first look for a ret, and then they say, what are the instructions before this? Or they look for a computed jump and say, what are the instructions before this? And that's how they get the list of possible things you can do. And that's, in fact, the main outcome of the tool I used. So the tool I used, which is the same as the one you used, I ran on libc, and it produces this output file, which I should edit in the text editor because it's way too long, of just a list of everything I could possibly do. And so using this, I said, gee, I would like to call something. I'm sorry this is an Intel syntax because the tool was written by someone who uses Intel syntax. So I would like to call someone. So I'm going to look for something with a call. So I'll just look for, search this thing for call, and I can see a bunch of candidates. So here, oh, here's something where I can call something if I load it in RCX. You know, I can also look for, hey, I want to load something in RDI. So I can look for, you know, maybe something that moves into RDI a value and say, oh, there's one, there's one, there's one. So if you need to produce it by hand, it's much easier to look through this list than it is to look through the raw object dump output. And if you're looking for just a push, you can search for exactly like, sorry, a pop, RDI, then a return. You can search for exactly that. And this tool tells you that's where one is. You might say, is there only one? The answer is no. So what this tool does is after it finds these returns and looks at the instructions before them, it eliminates duplicates. So there's probably multiple pop RDI rets in libc. It just gives us one. Sorry? Sorry. Right, yeah, okay. So it just gives us one example. And that's, you know, that's the information we can use to sort of construct our exploit. And built into the tool is a mode which actually just looks for gadgets of a particular type, of a particular pattern, and chains them together to perform an execute a shell command. It just looks for things that are commonly found. It doesn't always work, but it usually finds these particular types. If that didn't work, you just go through these by hand and figure out how can I do this. It's like a puzzle solving thing, which you could do, but in practice, you can usually find like a pop or something like that, and you can usually find like a syscall or a call in almost any library of large size, so you can like completely automate it by just saying there's probably a gadget that has these instructions. But if you can't, you get this big list, and you just search for, I want to do something with RDI, you just look for, where can I do something with RDI? And figure out how to make that work. So another thing that you might notice is that you know, we have all these addresses, and those are things that we actually need to put in our exploit string. And you recall that with machine code, I mentioned that we need to make sure our exploit string doesn't contain certain characters. For example, with getS, I can't use I can't use new lines. So this gadget here ends with a 10, hex 10, and that's a new line character. So I can't actually use this in my exploit. So that seems like a problem. And this tool, like many tools of this sort, has a mode where you can say, hey, I would like you to print out all the gadgets, but first filter out the ones which contain particular characters. So I have a file here which is all the gadgets, I could have a file, so I can get a file which is all the gadgets without the ones which contain new lines. So I can actually do that. So I can make it safe for my program. On the other hand, with these addresses, we're out of luck if we can't put null characters in it. Because all our addresses start with a null character, have a null character at the most significant byte. So, so that's return-oriented programming. So people who have studied this have pretty much found that you can take pretty much any non-trivial application and you can do pretty much anything in a really strong sense. So for those of you who've taken computability theory, they've generally been able to trivially show that the gadgets are Turing complete and let you do operating system calls. So it's almost always true. Like, it's really hard to find a programmer that isn't the case. And usually it's not so hard. So since most systems use write X or execute and are wills to use or use address space layout randomization, the actual procedure to do all the exploits we talked about is to first find a pointer to libc or some other thing which has lots of machine code, which is going to have these gadgets that you can find in it which do interesting little things like load a value into a register or call something based on a register. So find a pointer, use that to compute the value of every single other pointer in the thing in the library. And then your address randomization doesn't matter, write X or execute doesn't matter. All this code we're running is executable because it's part of the library that needs to be executed. And it also, if you have that information disclosure, probably it also reveals the stack canary. So it seems like stack canaries are still important with this. And also stack canaries are actually a bit of a problem for this, it would seem, because that means that we're not going to find as many of these returns, right? Because most of the returns are going to have a stack canary check then a return, would be our assumption. In practice, this isn't really a problem because typically stack canaries are only added to functions which have buffers in them. Because it's not worth the performance overhead of having a stack canary check when there's no buffer in a function. Also, because we can find return instructions in the middle of other instructions, like our example. We had that pop return, which was just part of a jump. And that's going to happen. And there's nothing wrong with jumping to the middle of an instruction as far as the processor is concerned. It says, oh, that's a pop instruction. Good. So the other thing is that we can use this same technique without a stack overflow. So it's most straightforward with a stack overflow, because usually we're going to find things that end with a return. But we can in fact do it without a stack overflow. So the basic idea is you just look for a gadget which sets the stack pointer. And you jump there first. So for example, in my libc, I found this gadget, pop RSP, push RDI, call, pop RSP, write. I found these two sequences of gadgets. So if I can set up RDX to contain the address of the second gadget, and RDI to contain where I put my buffer of instructions to run, I can make RDI be the stack pointer by running the sequence of stuff. And then I can do the rest of it the same way we did with the stack overflow. And this is commonly how people will, in practice, exploit those things like a vtable pointer overwrite. So I overwrite a vtable entry to point to the first gadget and call the vtable function, that virtual C++ method, with arguments I chose to make sure RDI and RDX are set correctly.
So how do you overwrite overriding the vtable entry without a step though?
So the question is, how are we overriding the vtable entry?
Having some sort of step
overflow. So we need some sort of buffer overflow, but it could be a heap overflow, for example. Or it could be a stack overflow that doesn't touch stack canaries. So that's what I have for today. So so some closing notes. There's a test next week. So just so you know, and next Monday is review. I'm gonna make sure people actually notice that, since you probably haven't looked at the schedule. Okay.